From the streets of Melrose Park to the trading floor of the Merc, he's fought for every dollar he's ever earned. And now, with personal liberty and our system of capitalism under assault in America, he's here to seize back our rights from the government. With a cigar in one hand and a copy of the Declaration of Independence in the other, he's Sean Thompson. And this is the Sean Thompson Show.
This looks like a job for me, so everybody just follow me, because we need a little controversy.
Now, in my tease for my next guest, this is going to be the second or maybe third time I've talked to my next guest. I have the utmost respect for him. He is a general counsel and the Barbara K. Olson Legal Counsel at Landmark Legal Foundation. I'm well aware of what he's done with his life and what a success he is. He's authored numerous briefs with the Supreme Court. He's a member of the Federalist Society and American Bar Association. He's licensed to practice law in Virginia and District of Columbia, where he does to save us from the constitutional atrocities. His name is Mike O'Neill. Mike, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Good, Sean. How are you this afternoon?
Well, as I was teasing to you coming on the show, I said, I am looking for a panacea to the constitutional atrocities we're experiencing. And apparently my audience went crazy because, you know, I'm a neighborhood guy. They didn't think I knew what it meant. But I am looking for a cure from the government that is more than happy to attack and assault constitutional principles. How do we get this toothpaste back in the tube? Because what we're living through, to me, is something I never thought we'd see here.
Well, I think we need a I think what happens is, it's a great question. I think what we saw during COVID, and this kind of links into some of the events of the past day or so. Let's talk about this. We saw with COVID, the left and the Democrats in this country took advantage of the COVID pandemic in context of voting. What they did throughout the country was they relaxed all of the voting regulations, all of the rules that states had in place. They convinced states and state legislatures and state officials to relax and remove all the protections that were in our voting system. So remember, you'd see instituted in practice, what happened was instituted widespread vote by mail, right? More people now voted by mail in 2020 than voted in person. So when you have vote by mail, you have opportunities for mischief. You have opportunities for individuals to commit acts of malfeasance. So I think we really need to get back to instituting reasonable protections and common sense protections on our voting system, on our electoral system. And I think people need to be aware of that before the elections come out. They need to make that an issue every day. You need to go to your local representative, your state legislatures, your state representatives, because those are the people that pass these laws. Those are the people that are entrusted with ensuring the integrity of the electoral process, and go back to them and say, hey, how we changed our voting process, how have we changed it and exposed it to risk and exposed it to malfeasance? Why don't we vote in person anymore? Why do we vote by mail? What are you doing to make sure that your voting records, that your voter rolls are accurate and up to date? How are you removing dead people? How are you removing people moved out of your jurisdiction?
You're talking to Chicago, baby. We don't remove dead people. That's the voting block of the Democrats. But here's the other thing, Mike, and this is the reality of it. The collective, no matter what they tout themselves, right? Today it's called democracy or the Democrat Party. But what it really is the collective. The collective has an offense, and they can attack a multitude of different liberties that only has a defense. Liberty only has defense. It has no offense because it's individual. So when you have these atrocities, and what you realize what we're experiencing is the natural progression of servitude. And the American people have had the liberty broken with the government's action, ironically, by a Republican president at the time, no matter what the excuse, of censorship of information, of restriction of freedom and property rights, of a violation of what it means to be free. And now you have that mindset where they're afraid, and now all they need is a phony virtuous mission to commit more fascism, more totalitarianism. And this is the part where I want to break that chain, where people are used to the Obama years to, you know, misusing and abusing power that was meant to be a republic as a democracy. So that's the part. Which do we take on first? Do we take on the voter? Do we take on the atrocity of COVID? Or do we take on the corruption therein? And when I originally had you on, we were going to talk about Randy Weingarten.
Yes.
And that's, you could go after all of that, because it all really is about hiding the money scheme in fascism, isn't it?
I think so. And I think, you know, when you're talking and you're talking about liberties and the very first, most important, I don't want to say most important, let's not minimize any of our liberties. But one of the initial things I think about of liberties, and this has been a concentrated attack on the First Amendment, on the right of free speech, right? And you're seeing it everywhere. And the left made a dedicated effort to weaponize speech, to say, okay, we're going to attack your right to free speech at every level, and made it acceptable to attack free speech. By controlling speech, then you make it that much easier to subvert liberty. And now you have subjective measurements. What is hate speech? You know, weaponizing hate speech. It's okay to suppress hate speech, or it's okay to jail somebody for uttering hate speech. These subjective standards that you're setting forth, that the left has set forth. And they're going about it. They're not really hiding it. They're doing it in plain sight. So you're seeing, again, you're seeing an evolution, a degradation of the electoral process. You're seeing attacks on fundamental liberties, particularly free speech. And I think those are really, and I think more people need to talk about this. Again, just going back to it, nobody thinks about, going back to attacks on the electoral system, nobody thinks about voting until you're about to vote, until election season arrives.
Yes.
But the time to think about that are the months before, are the times right now, the times when it's a dead issue, when you can make a lot of hay about it with your representatives. And I think you should be aware of, number one, efforts on the left to suppress speech, and number two, efforts to control the electoral process.
I didn't have you on afterwards, but I really wanted to. And that was after the Supreme Court nullified state legislatures. How in the world can I have that arrogance of liberty when my fallback was the Supreme Court, right? The Supreme Court will never let the bastardization of the federalism fall by the wayside and the culmination of federal corruption in Washington, D.C. But that's exactly what they did. So they, in essence, nullified the specific instance in the Constitution when state legislatures control voting rules and laws. So now that you've broken that, what's next?
Well, again, a very unfortunate decision. Those were two unfortunate decisions in an otherwise really good Supreme Court term. But again, I still think that the individual legislatures, in that particular instance, it was that decision. However, state legislatures, there are other Supreme Court decisions, recent Supreme Court decisions. The Brnovich decision, for example, is one that comes to mind immediately, which was just a couple of terms ago, where the state of Arizona, for example, outlawed ballot harvesting, right? That's the process where individuals, you have these third-party interest groups, you have unions or something, deploy at these precincts to go collect ballots for people that they're not related to. You know, it's not like you're taking your grandma's ballot to the mailbox for her. No. It's deploying individuals at targeted precincts to collect ballots, ballot harvesting. Now, the state of Arizona a couple years ago outlawed that. And the Supreme Court in the Brnovich decision said that states could do that. That was perfectly in line. It was not a violation of the Voting Rights Act. So there is some leeway. And again, I would encourage everybody listening out there, all your audiences, to talk about this in the times when nobody's talking about it, because that's when you can make an impact. So there is some things you can do. Again, in those cases you're talking about with out of North Carolina and out of, I believe, Alabama this term, those were very disappointing cases. But I still think there is work to be done at the state level.
What else was disappointing, as far as I'm concerned, is the success in the government takeover and backdoor nationalization of every aspect of our life during COVID. And when I originally had you on, it was going to be, why should the DHS take Randy Weingarten seriously after the pandemic? Want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, absolutely. It was announced that the president of the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, was appointed to the Homeland Security Academic Partnership Council. And that is a group, an advisory committee within the Department of Homeland Security that is going to do two things, really. They're going to identify funding opportunities, so access to federal money. So these are individuals, leftist individuals, who are sitting in a room deciding where they're going to allocate your taxpayer money. So they're going to identify grant funding opportunities. The second thing that this Homeland Security Academic Partnership Council is tasked with is safety and security, including prevention, response, mitigation, recovery, and other emergency management and preparedness measures. So taking those, advising on those issues. So look at this. Safety and security. This is an individual who was completely, totally wrong during COVID, who advocated for closure of schools, who advocated for masks, advocated for keeping kids at home. did incalculable damage, all in the name of safety, incalculable damage to the emotional, social, and academic progress of our children. Set them years back by any measure, particularly the most vulnerable students were set back years. And now you're putting this individual, who is the leading advocate for those measures, you're putting her in a position to command federal tax dollars and to advise on safety measures. I can't think of anybody who's less qualified to serve in that capacity.
Mike O'Neill, over the weekend, I had been doing a little research on Randy Weingarten. After all, the best Democrat mafia members always come from Chicago. And this is a girl that's riddled in scandal. In fact, there has been millions of dollars from the teachers union invested in a company during COVID called Empire Global Ventures. Empire Global Ventures was given millions of dollars to buy PPE for the schools. None of the PPE was ever delivered. None of it was ever questioned. It turns out it's a member of her synagogue and friends of both her and her wife. And this woman's name is Alexandra Stratton. And her husband is named Sam Natapov. I'm guessing. I don't know how to say it, but it's Natapovi Natapov. And they are the principals of this Empire Global Ventures in New York. And this is something that has never really been investigated. And this is a bipartisan issue. Tremendous amounts of money was stolen and misappropriated. What we now know is even the PPP loans, over 50% had been improperly given, and we don't know where the money is, and you've got other people that have stolen it. Are we ever going to be able to investigate this kind of scandal, bipartisan corruption, or have they successfully deluded us with too many scandals for us to go after the specific atrocities in the government's reaction to COVID?
It's like herding cats, absolutely. I have not heard of that. I would hope that anything regarding misappropriation of COVID relief funds would be fully investigated and audited. I had not heard of anything. Well, I had not heard of that.
That's she did it as the teacher union president. This is teacher union money. But so much of that money has the ambiguity of whoever is in charge. They pretty much are held harmless to invest the money in the way that they wanted. And she took the opportunity during COVID to supposedly buy PPE. Yet, a tremendous amount of money was spent. You can find this information in Puppeteers, by the way. That's where I was finding the most success. It was a former congressman who wrote it. And it's very interesting how instead of being investigated, instead of being held to account, it seems to be that they get promotions. And when I say they, I mean the facilitators of this kind of corruption.
And that's utterly mind-boggling to me, Sean. Again, there's no accountability and there's no humility. What's always astounding to me is Fauci, anybody you want to talk about, everything, they were absolutely wrong at every level, at every point, right? And if Mike O'Neill were one of the leading advocates for health or leading advocates for education, and I was out there every day saying something day in, day out, and then it was proven beyond any reasonable doubt that I was completely wrong. And in fact, I hurt the people I should be advocating on. In other words, our students and across America. And I was wrong. What would I do? I would apologize. I would demonstrate humility, self-reflection. I would go away. I wouldn't seek out appropriate appointments to prestigious councils who command lots of money and authority within our Department of Homeland Security. But that's what was always astounding to me. It's a lack of humility, lack of self-reflection. It is absolutely mind-boggling that this is going on today.
You have too much character to go into politics, but the problem is only a fraction of society has character. The rest don't, and that's who's in control of the levers of power. But I want to ask you if maybe they overplay their hand. Every once in a while, I keep hoping this happens. And as we look at what's happening with this indictment, and as I read the 45 pages, now I am not an attorney. Believe me, I don't pretend to be. However, this looks like a nonsense thing where you're assuming you knew what somebody else knew. It's a story of fiction. It doesn't seem very intelligent to me or to be very credible. But is it, in fact, an opportunity for the Trump team to open up through the process of the legal system and maybe really audit some of the allegations that they say he knew? Is this an opportunity for him?
Right. And that's an interesting point. My colleagues and I were talking about that today, and one of them pointed out that exact point, that there are a number of allegations here. And again, what was I talking about right at the beginning of our discussion? There, look, 2020 was a off year regarding elections. The left spent the entire 2020 removing any reasonable protections in a lot of these states. A lot of these states just implemented vote by mail on the fly. And so now there's all kinds of opportunities for mischief or malfeasance within that rapid implementation of vote by mail. And so it will be interesting. There is an opportunity there if you look at it. And again, another, just to speak quickly on the indictment, I think the special counsel is going to have a heck of a time trying to show mens rea on the part of the part of President Trump. I mean, if you read the indictment and you see all of these reckless words, quite frankly, where you're knowingly do that and intentionally, that is a very, very high bar to reach.
How the hell do you know what anybody else knows, first of all?
Right.
And how do you have the arrogance and the audacity to assume it, and then you put it in an indictment? You basically, that's an indictment of our Department of Justice, the way I look at it. That's a joke.
It's going to be, again, setting aside some of the other things, given where, at least initially, it looks like the case is going to be in the D.C., in the District of Columbia, although that's an issue to get, venue is an issue to challenge for the defense. But I think it's going to be very difficult. It's a very, very high bar to reach when you're trying. You can establish that I told you something, but you can't establish what was going on in your mind. If Sean, for example, I say, well, the sky is purple. Or the sky is blue today, Sean. The sky is blue. And you say, you can establish that I told you that the sky was blue, but I can't establish that you thought that the sky was blue. All I can establish is that Mike O'Neill told you the sky was blue. You see the problem where it gets into the mens rea, the intent of the target of the indictment here, President Trump. And by the way, his behavior has been perfectly consistent. He has consistently said that he believed the election was stolen.
So do I.
So I think that works in his favor.
I believe the election was stolen. I believe COVID was created in a lab. I believe masks are full of garbage, and I wouldn't put that vaccine in my arm for $10 million. Can I have the right to say that in America anymore, Mike?
Again, going back to what I was talking about before, this all kind of flips together, right? What are we saying? Attacks on our First Amendment, attacks on our free speech. And again, what is the most protected level of speech? Political speech should receive the highest level of protection in our country. And a lot of times I think that might be a really big issue here in the Trump indictment issue, is what is protected political speech?
You know, the hardest thing to wrap my head around as I get older is that I am completely convinced that in Washington, D.C., Trump could be convicted for shooting Tupac. There's no question in my mind. So we are now whatever judge, whatever party the judge is, however philosophically corrupted the people in law enforcement or in the FBI or the Secret Service. This is an America I don't recognize and I thought would never happen. And I'm wondering, in your heart of hearts, when you go to bed at night, with all of your history, with all of your action in front of the Supreme Court, are you confident we can still turn to the Supreme Court ultimately in the end after these atrocities pass us by?
I was generally happy with the term this term. We saw a lot of good decisions come down. I will say one thing. I wanted to make one point. You talked about overplaying the hand. I would say, if you look at the action, you know, we're forgetting, you see how the left moves, you see how the media moves. We haven't even touched on the Devin Archer testimony from yesterday, right? So I think if you want to look at overplaying their hand, I think if you look at the testimony of Devin Archer, I think you see a lot of exposure for President Biden and his son. So we'll see. Yeah. When you talk about it, it's funny how things might work out. There's a lot of serious questions that should be raised. And by the way, talk about special counsel. I think it's entirely important that a special counsel is appointed to invest, you know, good luck with that one, but investigate the Hunter Biden issues.
Before I let you go, and I'm going to let you go, but before I let you go, have you ever seen the documentary, ironically inspired by Hillary Clinton, and they hired a guy by the name of Hari Hursey called Kill Chain? Did you ever see it?
No, I did not.
Would you do me a favor? Would you, when you get some downtime, remember it. It's on Netflix. You can find it. It's called Kill Chain.
Great.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. You'll find it fascinating. In the meantime, I'm depending on you because I know you and the people at Landmark Legal Foundation are always fighting for the liberties and the Americanism this country is based on and the Enlightenment. So thank you, Mike, for making time for me. Mike O'Neill, I truly appreciate you.
Always a pleasure, Sean. You have a great day.
You too.